conflict must be resolved through negotiation, untethered from international law. I spoke about Canada's position with William Schabas. Schabas is a professor of international law at Middlesex University in the UK and professor of international law and human rights at Leiden University in the Netherlands. I reached William Schabas in the UK. Canada, the UK, the United States, of course, are arguing that the International Court of Justice should not render an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation, as requested to do so by the General Assembly in December of last year. And Canada and the United States and the UK and others, I suppose, are saying, no, no, the peace process is the purview of the Security Council. The UN General Assembly really has less purview over this. And besides, if the ICJ were to render an advisory opinion, it would make the peace process more difficult. It would drive the parties apart and actually be bad for peace. What do you make of such arguments? Like, what is one to make of the Canadian argument that the ICJ should not render an advisory opinion?
The position that Canada and others have taken, friends of Israel, essentially, are simply, it's couched in both in arguments both of law and of policy. So they're arguing that the court has discretion, although it will not. I would be astounded if it would decide to exercise its discretion not to issue an advisory opinion on the question. But in principle, it has it. And they are making a legal argument that this is an appropriate case to exercise the discretion. But of course, in order to bolster that argument, they have to use arguments that are not arguments of law, really, but arguments of policy. And it's this idea that, you know, keep it out of court, because it will make, as you have said, make it harder for them to reach an agreement to find some solution. But it's been 30 years since the Oslo Accords, and they were expected to bring about a solution within a reasonable number of years, and that hasn't happened. The frustration of the majority in the General Assembly, of the Palestinians themselves, at the inability to advance the negotiations towards a final two-state solution of the situation and proper self-determination for Palestine, means that all of these options have to be pushed and advanced. The Palestinians were very successful 20 years ago in the decision on the wall, 19 years ago, the decision, also an advisory opinion. And you know, you're probably aware of the fact that advisory opinions are relatively rare. The court has issued, I don't know, 15 or 20 of them since it started in the 1940s. It issued a number of them about Southwest Africa, occupied Namibia at the time, which moved the pieces on the chessboard forward for proper self-determination of the people of Namibia. And it definitely was a victory, the advisory opinion in 2004 for the Palestinians. And the hope is that this will push forward Palestine's campaign for full self-determination. And the Palestinians seem to be convinced of this. Many of their supporters are. And the opponents of the advisory opinion have shown that they're not really interested in full Palestinian self-determination, but rather they're backing Israel in the pursuit of the status quo or worse.
And their position, I mean, Canada's position, the U.S.'s position, the U.K.'s position, is that a solution to the conflict, quote-unquote, should be untethered from international law, that international law should not be a term of reference in resolving the situation. If one just looks at the settlement enterprise, the settlements are flagrantly illegal under Article 49.6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. They constitute a war crime under the Rome Statute, although, of course, the ICC has never adjudicated it. I mean, the settlement enterprise constitutes a flagrant breach. And yet the international community, like Canada, thinks shouldn't be the subject of any kind of litigation or court case. It'd just be a matter of negotiation.
You know, Canada is engaged in a lot of international litigation. Canada is involved in, I think, at least three cases at the International Court of Justice, which is phenomenal, and I don't think it's ever happened before. So Canada may not like what we sometimes call, maybe it's a pejorative term, but lawfare at the United Nations when Israel's involved. But they're certainly using lawfare to support Ukraine in the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. They're engaged in a form of lawfare in a case that they've filed against Syria. And there, the Canadian position is that law has to prevail. So the Canadian government's position is completely hypocritical. They invoke the law when they think it's going to advance their political ambitions. And when they think that it's going to be harmful to their political ambitions, then they say, well, this is a matter that shouldn't be sorted by law. I think it's a good test that if the Canadians and the British and the Americans think that seeking an advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice is not going to be helpful and it's not a good development, that would lead me to think that it probably is a good development.
Under international law, what are the obligations of state parties to conventions like the Geneva IV or the UN Charter, for that matter? What are Canada's and the UK's and the United States' and the international community's obligations under international law to hold Israel accountable for transgressions of international humanitarian and human rights law?
This is an unsettled area of law. Until quite recently, issues about fundamental human rights, certainly in the courtroom at the International Court of Justice, were disputes between states who had a direct interest in the matter. And it's only quite recently that we start to see disputes and litigation at the International Court of Justice and elsewhere where states are acting, they claim, on behalf of the international community. So when Canada is suing Syria at the International Court of Justice for violating the Torture Convention, Canada is not an injured state. As we say, Canada doesn't have any direct legal interest in it. Canada is really undertaking what we use a Latin term, actio popularis. Canada is claiming to represent the forces of good in the world, and arguably they may be doing that in Syria, but they're certainly on the wrong side in the case of Israel on all of this. But obligation, you know, we can argue that they have certain obligations. They tend to present it as the obligations are the ones owed by, for example, Israel to the world. So Israel owes obligations to the world and to the international, to other states under the Geneva Convention. When Israel violates the Fourth Geneva Convention, who are the injured states? Well, it's an occupied territory. Palestine maybe can argue that they're an injured state, but the broader argument is that all other states, because these are, when you have a treaty, there's both, it's a multilateral treaty, but there's a bilateral relationship between every state who's ratified it. So traditionally, you see the Geneva Conventions take an international armed conflict. Well, we didn't have the four Geneva Conventions we have now at the time of the Second World War. But when Germany mistreated a Canadian prisoner of war, that was a violation of the 1929 Prisoner of War Convention, but it was a dispute between Canada and Germany. The issue is when Israel violates the Geneva Conventions, do states like Canada and others, do they have a dog in the fight, so to speak?
But I mean, Article 1 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and of all the other three states, that all state parties shall respect and ensure respect for the convention in all circumstances. And the Fourth Geneva, the Geneva Conventions are incorporated into Canadian domestic legislation, the Geneva Conventions Act. So Canada is obligated under the Fourth Geneva Convention to respect and ensure respect for the convention in all circumstances. And yet one could argue Canada extends aid and assistance to Israel's settlement enterprise.
Well, then you're arguing that Canada is an accomplice to violations of the Geneva Conventions by Israel. And that's not the same thing as saying that Canada has an obligation to ensure that the Geneva Conventions are respected in all 195 odd countries on the planet or states parties to the Geneva Convention. So if there's a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention by the Cook Islands in the Pacific Ocean, is Canada under an obligation to take action to ensure that the convention is being honored? And I think that's a more difficult proposition.
But it's obliged not to render aid and assistance.
Sure, because then they are being an accomplice to a violation of the convention.
And Canada does that vis-a-vis Israel. Canada extends aid and assistance to the settlement enterprise.
Indeed. Absolutely. So this is an issue of where there are violations being committed and where Canada is acting as an accomplice. They're like the guy who drives the bank robbers to the bank and then drives them away when they've got the loot. You know, that's what they're doing. That's their role in law, and they understand that. They know that. They're not even going to argue with the fact that if you assist another country in violating international law, that you assume some obligation yourself for doing it.
Why do you think, Bill Chavis, that the International Criminal Court is moving so slowly, it would appear, on the Palestine case? And I'm looking at its budget allocations for the Office of the Prosecutor from 2023, and of the 10 major investigations, Palestine is allocated the smallest budget. The Palestine case gets 944,000 euros. That's the very, very, 944,000 euros. That's the very bottom of the heap. Ukraine gets 4.5 million euros. Venezuela gets 1.6. Palestine is at the very, very bottom of the budget allocation. And it's also got the smallest number of staff members, which I've got the figures here from 2023. It's got 6 people working on Palestine. Georgia has 3, and the Philippines have 6 as well. But the rest of them have, you know, way more, right? Uganda has 23 people working on the case. Ukraine has got a dozen. And Palestine's at the very, very bottom of the heap. How do you explain the ICC's apparent...
Why is this? Yeah, I'll explain. First of all, I think those figures are probably... There's some distortion in the figures, because I think that there's probably a lot more going to Ukraine than the figures demonstrate, because the Ukraine situation, not only has it become the focus of the court's budget and the main situation for the court, but there have also been very substantial contributions by states, what we call voluntary contributions, that mean that there's actually a lot more in resources going to Ukraine, even that are outside of the court's budget, including from Canada. So Canada has seconded a significant number of personnel to go to Ukraine. And so this is indirect, and it further distorts the selection of targets for the activity of the court. Further distorts it in the sense that it means that it's not just, I forget the figure you quoted, but 4.5 million for Ukraine. But I think the actual resources that are being devoted are much greater, but they don't appear on the budget because they don't come out of the budget. They're extra budgetary.
So what's going on with Palestine at the ICC in your view?
In my view, what's going on is that the decision makers in the Office of the Prosecutor, these are priorities that are assessed and determined by the Office of the Prosecutor and by the individual, the prosecutor himself. And the prosecutor is enthusiastic about Ukraine and not enthusiastic about Palestine. And why is that? Why is that? This is a mystery. As far as I'm concerned, it's the tragic flaw in the architecture of the International Criminal Court. Is it because of a rational assessment by the prosecutor after broad consultation that the Ukraine situation requires much greater resources than Palestine? Is it the result of a political decision by the prosecutor who doesn't think Palestine is important and thinks Ukraine is very, very important? Is it a result of somebody blackmailing the prosecutor by threatening to reveal some dark episode in the prosecutor's past? I know the prosecutor well. I'm not suggesting that he has any dark episodes in his past. But the point is, when you have a single individual who can take decisions about priorities like this and who is not really accountable to anybody for these decisions, the only accountability is when he comes up for re-election, except that there is no re-election. You cannot be re-elected to be prosecutor. So he has a 9-year term, and basically he decides based on his own personal assessments. It's in the Rome Statute, because when the statute was being drafted, and I participated in this process and attended most of the meetings, or many of the meetings, including the final conference in Rome in 1998, there was great opposition to what had previously been the mechanism for determining where international justice should be focused. And that mechanism was essentially ask the great powers to decide. In the 1990s, that meant the Security Council, and that meant in particular the permanent members of the Security Council. In 1945, at Nuremberg, that meant the victorious main Allied powers. When they decided in 1945 to have a Nuremberg tribunal for the German leaders, for example, Canada wasn't invited to the meeting. That was a meeting between the British, the French, the Americans, and the Soviets. So the big four powers, who then go on to be four of the five permanent members of the Security Council, they decide. So there was great resistance to this idea in the 1990s. And many countries, including Canada, took the view that this was unacceptable now. It was inconsistent with judicial independence. And so they said, we'll let the prosecutor be, we call it the independent prosecutor, the independent prosecutor. Now, we have independent prosecutors in our own national justice system. But the independent prosecutor in Toronto, for example, can't say, well, I'm going to, I think this, the problems, the main problems with criminal justice are in Scarborough. And so I'm going to just devote all my resources to Scarborough. If there's a murder or a rape in Etobicoke, I'm sorry, we're not going to do that because I just think it's more important to be active in Scarborough. A prosecutor who did that, who was acting independently, but who did that, would pretty soon be looking for another job. Because, you know, there's a presumption in a domestic justice system, and it's a rule, it's a rule under international human rights law, that all serious crimes have to be investigated and prosecuted, wherever they take place.
The supposition, of course, is that opening up a prosecution against leaders of the Israeli government would just bring the roof down on top of the International Criminal Court and its prosecutor, that the U.S., Canada, the EU would simply not allow it. It's just too politically unacceptable.
You're right. But what's the difference between an investigation into the leaders of Israel and an investigation into the leaders of Russia? They're prosecuting the president of Russia now for war crimes committed in Ukraine. They're doing the investigation. Canada, the United States, the Europeans, they love this. They're enthusiastic about it. But the rest of the world is not. The rest of the world is not. The rest of the world looks at this and sees a politically driven institution that is pursuing the policies. And you can see it in the, when you read out the numbers about where the investigations are taking place. That's just a reflection of the policies of NATO, of the European Union, and of Canada and the United States, which is the war. Their view is that the war in Ukraine is the great existential crisis in the last 50 years. And that's a European northern view of the world, but it's not shared by the South. So the problem that the court is going, and it's, and unfortunately the Palestinians are victims of this in a way, is that it's pursuing a global North agenda and it's ignoring a global South agenda. It's going to be very popular in the North, but it's going to become increasingly unpopular in the South, and what we'll be left with is effectively a regional institution. This is not what I campaigned for in the 1990s and what many people didn't. So in a way, Palestine, this is a great test for the court. A different prosecutor could easily have treated things differently. A different prosecutor might well have said, faced with Ukraine, that the Ukrainian justice system is willing and able to investigate and prosecute these cases. And states should give their money to the Ukrainian justice system and not expect the International Criminal Court, which is supposed to step in when the domestic legal system can't do the job. And that's the whole point of the International Criminal Court. We need the International Criminal Court to deal with the violations by the Israeli authorities of the laws of occupation in Palestine, because we don't have another court to do it.
The thinking about this, it appears to me that perhaps the trouble is that finding a person in Israel to prosecute, like who would you prosecute for the crime of having transferred 750 or 800,000 Israeli citizens into occupied territory in flagrant breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention? Who would you prosecute? It's not a single prime minister since 1967 who wasn't directly involved in it. Heads of the army, chiefs of staff, Supreme Court justices, ministers of every single government ministry in Israel. It's totally baked into the Israeli system. It's systemic, it's comprehensive, it's institutionalized. Who would you prosecute?
Well, they're doing this with Russia. The International Criminal Court didn't have any trouble figuring out whom to prosecute in Russia. They just focused on the president, and that's what they're doing.
Well, that's easy. I mean, Putin runs the country. It's Putin's show. But in terms of the settlement enterprise in Israel, who would you prosecute, Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, you would gather the evidence and put together the individuals who've been involved in these decisions. And I don't see any great difficulty. I don't see it as being legally, it's no more difficult than trying to prosecute Putin. Putin is not, this isn't the place to get into a discussion about Putin. He's not a dictator like Hitler was or something. I mean, there's a state, there's a parliament in Russia, there are generals, there's an army and all of this. The leader is important, but the leader is important in Israel. The leader is important in the United States. They all have a huge role. And no, I don't see any problem with doing it. Obviously, it'll come down to the facts of the situation. And any individual, a leader in Israel who is prosecuted by the court, would be able to invoke various defenses, saying, I wasn't at the meeting, I didn't vote for it, I was opposed to it, I didn't contribute to it. But if they contribute to it, then you're going to find that they were violating the rules that are in Article 8 of the Rome Statute that are derived from the Fourth Geneva Convention, and that would be a war crime under international law.
We don't have too much time left, William Schabas, but a question. Article 80 of the United Nations Charter, under Article 80, I gather, the United Nations, the international community, the United Nations, continues to hold the Palestinian right of self-determination as a sacred trust, that it has survived the mandate and it is still sitting in the agenda and on the docket of the UN General Assembly. Well, what do you make of that argument? Is that sacred trust still alive?
I mean, this is a notion that we get from going back to the Charter of the United Nations, and it's antecedent because, of course, Palestine was originally Ottoman territory and it was given to the British at the Paris Peace Conference, basically, and was determined to be a mandate. So that's the idea, that's the origin of it. And the British deviously withdrew from all of that in the 1940s. But it's a good argument, but I don't know that it's a game changer as an argument. It's a useful argument. But obviously getting the United Nations to determine its sacred trust. It's a complex organization as well. The countries of the South are very dominant now. They weren't back 75 years ago, but they're very dominant and have been for many, many years in the General Assembly. But they're not so dominant in the Security Council. In the Security Council, of course, we encounter essentially the huge role played by the five permanent members who run the Security Council. They don't totally run it. But, you know, the UN is a complicated institution, and ultimately it's political about getting it to act. One of the things that's changing as well, of course, are the fact that the Gulf states are finding some way to reconcile with Israel in some way, and that's not going to be helpful to the Palestinians either in the coming years. I think they're very aware of this.
Last question. Do you despair of international law, William Schabas? It seems to be an entirely notional sort of structure and institution. You believe in it. If you believe in it, you enforce it when you want to, and you don't when you don't wish to. That it's really just a nice idea, but it doesn't really have any consistent and practical effect. Maybe that's not quite the right way to put it.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I think that international law, it's a body of law it's incomplete. It's not enforceable in the way that we think of domestic law being enforceable. That's just inherent in its nature, you could say, because it's made up of rules that apply between sovereign states who are sometimes governed by law, sometimes acting on the basis of what they think their legal obligation is, and sometimes being dismissive of their legal occupation and just acting on behalf of what they think their best interests are. So it's more complicated in a way, or more imperfect, if you want, if we try to make analogies with how domestic law applies in a democratic system where there's the rule of law, where citizens can go to court and challenge, and where the judges are independent of the government, and so on. International law is more complex that way, but it's the field I work in. And I suppose if you want to ask why, I like and I'm fascinated by the mixing of the politics and the law. It's what makes it interesting for me. But it certainly is very, we're in a constant campaign. I don't know, maybe that's not the right word, but I feel that my own existence as an academic, mainly as an academic, has been trying to point out the inconsistencies, the double standards, and to try to hold states, particularly the states of the North, who love to lecture the states of the South and treat the world the way they did historically under international law, as something that belonged to what they called the civilized nations. But actually, they've often behaved in a very uncivilized way and continue to do so. For me, that's the challenge, is to point out the inconsistencies, incoherences, and double standards, and hopefully get countries to behave better than they do.
William Chavis, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
My pleasure.
William Chavis is professor of international law at Middlesex University in the UK and professor of international law and human rights at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Read more about the ICJ's upcoming advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation of Palestine at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.
Bird calls can sound like something else altogether. For example, one could easily mistake the call of a male yellow rail for someone tapping two small stones together. What about this sound? They're turkey vultures hissing at one another over a carcass. What about this plaintive whistle? That's the call of a male sea duck, a black scoter. And what could possibly be going on here? That's a duet between a male and female barred owl. And this one? Do we have a miniature cow with a chainsaw? No. That's the call of the rhinoceros auklet, a seabird deep in its nest burrow. Finally, what bird call resembles the howl of a wolf? That's the whale call of the common loon. What an amazing array of sounds birds have to offer. Ours are brought to you by arrangement with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and you can hear them all again at birdnote.org.